The notion that aid organisations and governments have the responsibility and the right to intervene into sovereign states in the name of humanitarianism has become so popular that today I think it's often just seen as common sense. Journalist David Reif, who's fairly critical of humanitarianism, sums up the prevailing mood in the following way. Some words are incantatory, and none more so by the end of the millennium than humanitarianism. Only human rights comes close to having the same quality of seeming morally impeccable. Reasonable people might differ in their evaluation of the ways that a particular humanitarian or human rights campaign or relief effort is carried out, but not over the desirability or moral imperative of such undertakings, he says. To say anything else is to lay oneself open to the charge of being against humanitarianism and against human rights. It is like saying that one is against a better world. Now, Marxists, of course, are implacably for a better world. We demand it and we think that such a world is possible. But we're also implacably opposed to the notion, however well-intentioned, that poverty and injustice can ever be improved under capitalism through the intervention of imperialist states, whether through aid or through military intervention. Aid, peacekeeping missions, humanitarian interventions, human rights protection operations, which is apparently the new term for invasion, all of these not only fail to alleviate human suffering and they can intensify it in some cases, they provide an ideological cover for imperialist interventions, not least during the latest round of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the idea that humanitarianism can improve people's lot is a myth, and I think it's a really cruel myth at that. The slogan, Make Poverty History, is a good example of the way that this myth can captivate us here in the West. And leaving aside the dim-witted pop stars who sort of flocked to hitch their wagons to this cause, we saw millions of everyday people who poured their money, time and energy into a seemingly radical demand out of their genuine concern for the state of the world today. But the truth is that poverty, injustice and oppression will never be history, while capitalism, a system that puts profit before all else, continues to exist. No matter how much charity or humanitarian sentiment or action there is, life for most of the population actually continues to get harder. But the argument that I want to make here is not just that humanitarianism under capitalism is inadequate and often futile, although I think that it is. I also want to argue that humanitarianism as we know it today has a direct ideological link with the notions of charity, of missionary zealotry, and the white man's burden that helped to justify colonial suppression in the 19th century. And I want to make the point that arguments in favour of humanitarianism have a long and quite sordid history of being used to justify imperialist military interventions. And finally, I want to argue that the human catastrophes like the ones currently unfolding in Iraq, Afghanistan and Darfur are not aberrations but are part of the historical continuum of capitalism's destruction, and as such, they can't be solved by imperialist intervention, even when it's dressed in the sheep's clothing of humanitarian rhetoric. The myth of humanitarianism naturalises the divisions that exist between rich and poor, the developed and developing world, and it cements the idea that the only solution to wars, to famines and disasters lies within the framework of capitalism, the very system that has created these crises in the first place. David Reif writes that humanitarianism is hope for a disenchanted time. If it claims to redeem, it does so only in the limited sense that in the world so disfigured by cruelty and want, it intervenes to save a small proportion of those at risk of dying and to give temporary shelter to a few of the many who so desperately need it. Now, there's another definition as well based on the supposed Western ideology of human rights popularised by Bernard Kouchner, the founder of Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and he's one of the most well-known advocates of humanitarianism today. And this is the doctrine of interference, or what the United Nations calls the responsibility to protect. And throughout the later years of the 20th century, this doctrine has given cover to military interventions waged by rich countries on poor in the name of human rights. But by either the limited standards of David Reif's definition or even in the more aggressive terms of Kouchner's, I think it's pretty clear in these early years of the 21st century that humanitarianism has failed its own aims. And the price of this failure is cruelty and want on a grand scale. According to the World Food Programme, 25,000 people have died today, as they do every day, from hunger and poverty. 852 million people currently do not have enough to eat. Every 5 seconds, a child dies because he or she is hungry. And this is just the sort of quotidian, everyday tale of human misery. It gets a lot worse. In the 1990s, global poverty dropped by 20%. Yet the number of hungry people actually increased by 18 million. And the number of chronically hungry people in the world today is actually growing by an average of 4 million per year at current trends. Then we can add to this the world's fastest growing refugee crisis sparked by the Iraq War, where more than 1.2 civilians have been killed in the past 5 years and 5 million people, almost one in five Iraqis, have been displaced. Then add to the mix Afghanistan, another country in crisis. Drug production is booming and warlords rule the countryside. The US and their allies have bombed most of the country into the Stone Age, and shortages of food and essential goods regularly threaten the livelihood of the population. Currently, up to 900,000 Afghans are registered refugees living in Iran, where they eke out a tenuous existence. And it's estimated there are up to one million more people, Afghan people, living in Iran illegally, facing the constant threat of deportation. Then at the ongoing crisis in the Darfur region of Western Sudan, where up to 450,000 people have been killed and up to 2.5 million people displaced since the Sudanese government launched its campaign of ethnic cleansing in early 2003 in response to an insurgency. The picture made up from these three flashpoints, and of course they're simply the most prominent of the world's many crisis zones today, this picture is a really grim one. But what they each have in common, besides the sort of statistics that provoke utter despair, is that they're all countries where imperialist interventions have been or are being waged and justified in the name of human rights or humanitarianism. And I think the war in Iraq, to start with, is of course widely hated, and millions of people around the world refused from the very start to give any ground to the arguments that the US had any humanitarian intention of liberating Iraqis from dictatorship, as they put it, as part of the convenient add-on to their real strategy with the war on terror. But humanitarianism was a more compelling shroud for the war in Afghanistan, with the US able to spin its push for oil revenue and power in Central Asia as a war against the evil, terrorist-spawning Taliban, whose human rights record, particularly when it came to women, was repellent to many Western onlookers. And at the start of the invasion, the US even took the trouble of dropping some food parcels along with its bombs to emphasise that it was selling this one, at least when necessary, as a humanitarian war. And Afghanistan is still today often perceived to be the good war. But the ever-deepening quagmire that the US finds itself in, coupled with the resurgence of the Taliban and the drug trade and regular reports of civilian lives in crisis, I think makes the argument that this war was ever intended to benefit Afghan people increasingly difficult to promulgate. It is the war in Darfur that has reinvigorated the argument that imperialist military interventions can have humanitarian aims. And Sudan, one of the world's 25 poorest countries, has gone through a devastating social crisis for nearly 30 years, culminating in the outbreak of this latest war in 2003. The really horrific conditions that the people of Darfur are forced to endure began to be widely reported in the international media in 2004, and calls for armed intervention into the crisis, some from left-wingers who'd been quite prominent in their opposition to the war in Iraq, began. There were a series of demonstrations, particularly in the United States, which launched the Save Darfur campaign, built around demands for a joint UN-NATO peacekeeping force that could act alongside the tiny African Union forces with a mandate to impose peace using force if necessary. In July 2007, the UN Security Council voted to send 26,000 peacekeeping troops to Sudan, one of the largest UN missions in history. And the mission is expected to cost more than $2 billion in its first year alone. And the Security Council has granted it the authority to use military force to carry out its aims. Now, I think the consequences for the people of Darfur and other oppressed people all around the world have yet to play out. But the underlying goals of this so-called humanitarian mission and the bloody history of such missions undertaken by both the United Nations and the United States should be ringing alarm bells in all our minds. And I think for the first achievement of the Save Darfur campaign, unfortunately, has been with its shameful appeals to US imperialism, has been to aid the US in its attempts to rehabilitate and make credible US military intervention at a time when such interventions were becoming totally discredited for millions of people around the world. Because for all the gift wrapping of a United Nations sanction, the Sudan mission will be yet another expression of US military force and US strategic aims in the oil-rich region. The scramble for oil and the need to outmuscle potential rivals like China, which already has $8 billion invested in oil infrastructure in Sudan, are the real reasons the US mobilised the Security Council to vote for an invasion. And as early as 2006, US socialists Avery Weir and David Whitehouse asserted that the US is playing a cynical, murderous chess game on a board that's much, much bigger than Darfur. They point out that the call for UN troops essentially opens the door for the United States, which uses the United Nations as just another arm of its imperial reach. It opens the door not just to Sudan, but to a renewed plunder of Africa's untapped oil and other resources. For the while, the US has refused to commit its own troops to Darfur, and we know that they're currently preoccupied with mass slaughter elsewhere. It will wield its influence through its links with the African Union forces. US corporate contractors, including DynCorp and Pacific Architects and Engineers, provide transport, communication and other support to African Union troops. And John Pike of globalsecurity.org has commented that the United States wants to cement its offshore military presence, filtered through its African Union alliances, on the oil-rich coast of West Africa. Since this strategy reduces, and I'll quote you, reduces the impression of a neo-colonial manoeuvre. So far, there's been a clear preference to lie low and work through African institutions to train troops and strengthen security. And I think we can predict that the intended beneficiaries of this strategy are not the suffering people of Darfur or any other African nation, but in fact are US corporations. Now, the crisis in Darfur is often wrongly presented as a conflict between Christians and Muslims, but in fact the majority of the population are Muslim, and many of the divisions still present today are actually a legacy of British colonialism. Britain took power over Sudan in 1898 to 99, and they immediately began to consolidate their power by setting Christians against Muslims, and in the Darfur region particularly, Arabs against Africans. And the main interest of the British was in the produce of the fertile Nile Valley, which they controlled from the northern city of Khartoum. The justification for this and for all other colonialist ventures was, of course, to uplift the backward races, what the infamous imperialist poet Rudyard Kipling called the white man's burden. Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed, go bind your sons to exile to serve your captive's need, to wait in heavy harness, unfluttered folk and wild, your new caught sullen peoples, half devil and half child. And I think that, you know, we can see that there are the implications behind this poem, the actual approach to the human population who suffer from the effects of colonialism. A German historian defines colonialism as a relationship of domination between indigenous or forcibly imported a majority and a minority of foreign invaders. The fundamental decisions affecting the lives of colonised people are made and implemented by the colonial rulers in pursuit of interests that are often defined in a distant metropolis. Rejecting cultural compromises with the colonised population, the colonisers are convinced of their own superiority and of the ordained mandate to rule, which we can, I think, really see in Kipling's poem. But it gives us a much more succinct definition, and one that could have come straight from the mouths of Howard, Blair or Bush in their justifications for invading Iraq and Afghanistan. Imperialist invasions, writes Kipling, are called savage wars of peace. The scramble of the major imperialist countries for colonies in the late 19th and early 20th centuries stemmed from the drive of the leading capitalist powers for access to markets and raw materials and for greater investment opportunities. And the experience of colonialism was never benign and was never intended to be benign. In the 1880s, when Belgian King Leopold II seized Congo, he won a reputation in Europe as a great humanitarian. He decreed an end to the slave trade in the territory and he said he was going to bring civilization to the indigenous people. But meanwhile, the king's armies were driving thousands of Congolese into forced labour on rubber plantations. The Belgians subjected the indigenous people to the most horrific tortures and brutalities, ultimately driving down the region's population by 10 million. And there have been countless countries since that have experienced similar destruction, and their populations have learned too late that the so-called liberators or humanitarians who invade under the pretext bring with them no such liberation or humanitarian relief, but rather the murderous legacy of imperialism's insatiable drive for resources, profits and power. In the late 20th century, these rampages were largely carried out by the United States, which emerged after World War II as the most powerful imperialist nation. And often the US would hide behind the United Nations or NATO to add legitimacy to its actions. And always, US intervention has resulted in, at best, entrenched poverty and continued human misery, and at worst, outright slaughter. The US intervened in Somalia in 1992 with the cynically named Operation Restore Hope under the pretext of famine aid. And although the worst of the famine was actually over by that stage. Picking up UN cover after the invasion, the US-led peacekeepers sided with one set of Somali warlords against the others, and in 1993 they precipitated 10,000 Somali deaths and injuries in the space of just 4 months of fighting. UN troops famously committed atrocities against the Somali population, the most publicised and I think one of the most horrific being the incident where Belgian troops were photographed roasting a Somali boy over a fire. The US-led Kosovo War of 1999, waged under the banner of NATO in the name of refugees, actually drove the Kosovo refugee population up from 45,000 to 800,000. Then there's Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, East Timor. These are just a few of the more recent examples of US and/or UN interventions that have left shattered societies in their wake. And yet each time war drums are beaten in the name of human rights, people, even left-wing people, pin their fragile hopes on the idea that this time, somehow, things will be different. And Wieron Reithaus wrote, "The perennial idea that imperial forces can somehow be made to do some good just this one time relies on a focus on isolated crises without a sense of what really moves imperial governments into action." If we actually look at the way the US has used past humanitarian crises for strategic gain or ignored them when there's been no strategic benefit, then such illusions make absolutely no sense at all. But I think it's even worse than just being wrong or not making sense, because each resurgence in support for imperial aims means that colonialism is effectively rehabilitated in humanitarian clothes. And those who pay for that rehabilitation are usually the people of poor and developing countries. I want to say something very briefly now about the proliferation of aid organisations and non-government organisations, NGOs, and the role that they play in all of this. And it's not the main point of this session. It could really be an entirely separate meeting on its own. But I think there are a couple of points to make about the way that they sort of play into all of these ideas. And the first is that so-called aid that travels from the West to developing countries always has either explicit or implicit strings. And I think we can see that very much with imperialist countries like Australia and the United States, who really, you know, they make the decisions about where to direct their aid based on their own strategic goals. David Reif has argued that humanitarianism is increasingly part of the foreign policy of the US government, and I would argue that we should regard it with the same suspicion, contempt, and resistance that accompanies other US foreign policy. Now, there are, of course, an ever-growing number of NGOs and independent organisations who claim to be much, much more independent, though many of them actually do rely on some level of government funding. And I think our approach to these organisations, in essence, should be like our approach to other reformist organisations that attempt to reform rather than overthrow capitalism. By attempting to work with neoliberal governments, NGOs hope that small, incremental changes can be made to improve people's lives. But instead of pulling governments towards a more noble humanitarian cause, some NGOs have been pulled into the orbit of a system that's organised around profit and exploitation. I think that one of the most recent examples of this was during the start of the war in Iraq, when World Vision actually agreed to work under Pentagon supervision as part of their negotiations with the US in order to be allowed to stay in the country. Now, there were other organisations like Oxfam and Médecins Sans Frontières who were vocal in their criticism of this stance. However, these activist aid organisations, as they're known, during the 1990s have supported calls for humanitarian military intervention in countries like Bosnia, Rwanda, Kosovo and East Timor. And far from opposing the militarism of imperialist powers, they have argued explicitly that when the limits of humanitarian aid are reached, soldiers must act. And such calls, I think, can only give legitimacy and humanitarian cover to the imperial ambitions of the United States. And arguably, they help to justify and to create a space for the US to try to justify its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think somehow the worst thing about the NGOs is the fact that they trade in futility, fueled by the passion and the energy of often very young people who really, who are genuine about wanting to see change in the world. And instead of change for the better, these people come up against the harsh realities of capitalism and the narrow confines of the aid industry's limitations. And there's just two small examples of this, recent examples that I wanted to give you. The first is in Cambodia, where landmine casualties have actually increased after the year 2000, despite a huge increase in demining and education, in which the NGOs have played a really large part. And according to a Landmine Monitor report, mine risk education reached about 600,000 people in 2004, which is really significant. But there was a significant increase in the number of casualties due to unexploded ordnance compared with 2003. And despite the immense amount of work being done to clear mines, often in really dangerous situations, and to educate people, rural Cambodians have been pushed back further into previously uninhabited countryside as land values rise due to a construction and tourism boom. And so capitalism marches on and traipses over human rights despite the efforts of aid workers, and I think the very genuine efforts of some workers. And the tragic result of the ruling class's drive for development and profits has been just to cancel out the reforms around landmines that initially seemed to hold so much promise. The second example is documented by Naomi Klein in her book The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And Klein observed, after travelling to Sri Lanka in the wake of the 2004 tsunami, that foreign investors and international lenders had teamed up to use the atmosphere of panic to hand the entire beautiful coastline over to entrepreneurs who quickly built large resorts, blocking hundreds of thousands of fishing people from rebuilding their villages. So the efforts of the aid organisations and the NGOs, and even all the people, if you remember, who just donated millions upon millions of dollars to aid for tsunami victims, all those people who rushed to assist tsunami victims were again subsumed to the dictates of capitalists who saw this crisis as an opportunity. Now, I think the limitations of humanitarian aid are expressed absolutely perfectly in a poem written at the start of the Great Depression. And because I had to inflict Kipling on you at the start of this talk, I thought I might finish and start to wind up with his opposite, one of the great revolutionary poets, Bertolt Brecht. And this poem is called A Bed for the Night. I hear that in New York, at the corner of 26th Street and Broadway, a man stands every evening during the winter months and gets beds for the homeless there by appealing to passers-by. It won't change the world. It won't improve relations upon men. It will not shorten the age of exploitation, but a few men have a bed for the night. For a night the wind is kept from them and the snow meant for them falls on the roadway. Don't put down the book on reading this man. A few people have a bed for the night. For a night the wind is kept from them. The snow meant for them falls on the roadway. But it won't change the world. It won't improve relations among men. It will not shorten the age of exploitation. And until our age of exploitation is ended once and for all, the sort of horror that we see today in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Darfur will continue to unfold. And I think it's utterly illogical to think that the exploiters, the ruling class, those who feed off the misery of the world's exploited and downtrodden, will ever act in the interests of humanity. They act for their class, and as Naomi Klein points out, they see human crisis not as a tragedy, but as a business opportunity, a way to make a quick profit or consolidate their power. Importantly, I think arguing against imperialist military interventions, actions that masquerade as humanitarianism, this is not a call to inaction, as we're so often accused. I think rather it's a call to do more, to act, to build the kind of force that can approach these absolutely critical questions with a political solution that can help people, that can actually change the world. And that political solution is socialism. And arguing for socialism doesn't mean sitting back and thinking that the way that the world is now under capitalism is the way that it has to be. It doesn't mean putting off real change to a distant socialist future. I think revolutionary socialists have historically been some of the most tenacious fighters for reforms that can actually have some effect on people's lives and that can actually cut through the ravages of imperialism. And just to go back to the example of Sudan, which I think for lots of people just seems so hopeless, and this is part of the reason why they've just capitulated into arguing for imperialist intervention, I think there are some of the demands that the left could have made for Sudan that don't strengthen the US's hand would have been perfectly viable for this campaign to take up. And they include cancelling Sudan's debt, welcoming refugees into Europe and the US, fully funding the Sudanese people's immediate needs, breaking off CIA contact with the government and pulling out the disgusting paramilitary private contractors. All of these things could have actually been demanded and fought for and had a direct impact on the livelihood and the lives of the Sudanese people. I think, but more than even particular demands, the politics behind them is what really counts. The exploited and oppressed of Africa, of the Middle East and of Central Asia don't need, illusions in the charitable intentions of US power that seem so popular here in the West. They need anti-imperial allies. They need us to hold the US to account and to hold them back in order to give oppressed people a breathing space to be able to identify and defeat their oppressors at home. And I think that's what's really missing from the focus on humanitarianism, whether we're talking about AIDS or whether we're talking about bombs. The idea that the downtrodden might actually be able to stand up to imperialism and to fight to liberate themselves. Because really, rights can't be imposed or created by humanitarian intervention. They have to be fought for and won. And we've heard plenty of examples this weekend of how that's been done, particularly, I think, the inspiring example of the South African working class who did just that and whose struggle continues on the African continent today. But I want to finish with the example of the Iraqis, because I think before this war even began, their society was pretty much decimated. Over 500,000 children and countless adults died as a result of UN sanctions. In the last 5 years, as I said, there's been a further 1.2 million deaths and just, unbelievable destruction. And yet they have continued to resist US occupation against all odds, really, and in the face of, incredible oppression. And standing with them and standing against every single step that the United States takes, no matter what kind of rhetoric it's dressed up in, I think that's the only hope that we have of seeing a world where the question of human rights can be resolved in the interests of most of humanity.